Imagine a world, I mean, not that long ago, where you had these extremes. On one hand, huge wealth for, you know, a tiny few. And on the other, just widespread misery, terrible conditions for ordinary working people. This was the Industrial Revolution right at its peak, a time that, yeah, promised freedom, but often felt more like new kinds of injustice. And bubbling up underneath all this, radical ideas, socialism especially, gaining a lot of ground, pushing for really drastic changes like getting rid of private property altogether. It's right into this this really intense moment, May 15th, 1891, that this document drops. Rerum Novarum. It's an encyclical from Pope Leo XIII. Now, for anyone not familiar, an encyclical is basically an official letter from the Pope on a big issue, but this one, wow, it wasn't just another letter. It fundamentally changed Catholic social teaching, sort of dragged it into the modern world. It's seen as the cornerstone, really. So on this deep dive, that's our mission. We want to unpack this huge encyclical. We'll look at the history, what was going on at the time. We'll dig into the main themes and, maybe most importantly, figure out why it still matters. Why these ideas about justice, dignity, and balance are, well, still incredibly relevant for all of us today. We want to pull out the key takeaways, give you a clear, solid understanding of its legacy. Okay, so to really get Rerum Novarum's impact, we kind of need to paint the picture first. What was 1891 actually like? What was the world that Pope Leo XIII was looking at when he wrote this?
Well, as you said, it was a world in profound upheaval, just massive change. The Industrial Revolution was absolutely peaking. You had this huge shift. People who'd lived on the land for generations suddenly moved into these, frankly, squalid industrial towns. Imagine that shift from a tight-knit village to being anonymous in a huge, dirty city.
That's a massive shock to the system.
Huge. And then mass migrations across Europe, people desperate for work, families splitting up, and the work itself. Grueling hours, tiny wages, really dangerous conditions. While at the very same time, a small elite was gathering just enormous wealth. The gap was stark. And like you mentioned, socialism was really taking off, heavily influenced by Marx. You know, these movements were pushing hard, promoting communism, arguing that abolishing private property was the answer to all this injustice. Pope St. John Paul II, looking back, called it a time when a traditional society was passing away and another beginning to be formed, one which brought the hope of new freedoms, but also the threat of new forms of injustice and servitude. That really captures it.
Yeah, that paints a really vivid picture of the tension. So with things stretched so tight, how did Rerum Novarum step in? It wasn't just complaining about the problems, right? It was offering something else, an alternative.
Exactly. Right at the peak of this clash, Pope Leo XIII intervened. With Rerum Novarum, he, and the church with him, directly confronted this divided society, spoke in really pointed terms. But crucially, he offered a balanced view, a moral vision, one that rejected those extremes, especially the socialist call to abolish private property, while always prioritizing human dignity. That was central.
Okay, so that gives us the stage. Facing injustice, facing these radical ideologies. Where did the Pope start? You mentioned he didn't begin with, like, governments or big economic systems. He started smaller.
Yeah, he started with the individual worker and the dignity of their work. He strongly upheld work itself as honorable, essential to being human.
Yeah.
The encyclical basically says there's no shame in earning your living through labor. It even points to Jesus Christ. Is he not the carpenter, the son of Mary?
Ah, interesting connection.
Right. It stresses that every worker, no matter their job or status, deserves respect, deserves fair treatment. Rerum Novarum directly called out the misery and wretchedness pressing so unjustly on the majority of the working classes. It demanded an end to that exploitation. It's his powerful statement about the inherent value of human effort. And here's something really fascinating. How strongly Rerum Novarum defends private property. It calls it a natural right, not just, you know, a good idea, but something fundamental, rooted in human nature, rooted in divine law.
Natural right. Okay.
Yes. The idea is that people have a right to own things, including land or capital, to secure their own living, to provide for their families. It states it very clearly. The first and most fundamental principle, if one would undertake to alleviate the condition of the masses, must be the inviolability of private property.
Okay, so if private property is fundamental, how did that play into the critique of socialism? What was the conflict there?
Well, it directly calls the socialist plan abolishing private property, putting everything under state control. It calls that emphatically unjust.
Emphatically unjust. Strong words.
Very. The argument was, look, this undermines freedom because it takes away the rewards of your own work. It also messes up the state's proper role, makes it too powerful, overreaching. And crucially, the Pope predicted it would just lead to chaos, societal disorder, economic stagnation. It says, socialists strike at the interests of every wage earner. The remedy they propose is manifestly against justice.
So hurting the very people it claimed to help.
That was the argument, that it would breed conflict, drive the sources of wealth, violate natural rights, and just throw society into confusion.
All right, so private property is defended, socialism is critiqued. What does this mean for the everyday relationship between the boss and the worker?
It means they both have responsibilities, mutual duties. It's not a one-way street. Employers, for instance, absolutely must pay a just wage.
And what does just wage mean here? Just enough to survive?
No, more than that. The encyclical says wages ought not to be insufficient to support a frugal and well-behaved wage earner. So enough for the worker and their family to live reasonably, not just bare minimum survival.
Okay, that's a significant point.
Definitely. And employers also have to provide safe working conditions. Exploiting workers is condemned really harshly, called a grave sin that cries to the avenging anger of heaven.
Wow, that is strong language, especially from a pope. And what about the workers? What were their duties?
Well, workers are called to do their jobs diligently, faithfully, and to respect the employer's property. So, employ their skill and strength faithfully is the phrase used. But it's also crucial to see that this rejects, you know, pure, unrestricted capitalism, too.
Yeah.
The idea that profit is everything. That kind of thinking, the encyclical warns, leads straight to exploiting workers.
So it's seeking a balance.
Exactly. A balance where labor and capital aren't enemies, but partners. They should work together for the common good. It stresses how much they need each other.
Now, something that might surprise people, unions. The Pope in 1891 was arguing for workers' unions. That seems pretty ahead of its time.
It really was quite a statement for 1891. Pope Leo XIII explicitly affirmed the right of workers to form associations or unions. He saw it as, well, partly a natural expression of human freedom, people associating together, and also as a practical way for workers to actually secure fair wages and decent conditions.
So both a right and a practical tool.
Precisely. He said very clearly, private societies cannot be prohibited by the state. To enter into a society of this kind is the natural right of man, unquote. And he added that these unions should be independent, you know, respond to what workers actually needed locally, and adapt as times changed. Then there's the role of the state, the government, where Yeoman of Arms says its fundamental job is to uphold justice, to protect the rights of everyone, but especially the poor and vulnerable. It puts it like this: whenever the general interest or any particular class suffers or is threatened with harm, the public authority must step in and deal with it.
Okay, so the state definitely has a role, an obligation to step in, especially for those who need help. But you mentioned limits earlier. What were those limits on state power?
Yes, the limits are really key to the whole balance. The state has duties, but it must not overreach. It shouldn't strip individuals or families or communities of their own rightful responsibilities and freedoms, like the freedom to own property.
Right. Don't absorb everything.
Exactly. The document says the state must not absorb the individual or the family. Both should be allowed free and untrammeled action, as long as it fits with the common good. And this is where we first really see the principle of subsidiarity laid out clearly in this context.
Subsidiarity. Okay, what's the core idea there?
The core idea is basically that higher level bodies, like the central government, shouldn't take over functions that lower level, smaller, more local groups can handle effectively themselves. So government help is justified when needed, but let families, communities, local associations do what they can do first. Keep decisions and actions as local as possible.
That makes a lot of sense. Keep power close to the ground unless there's a real need for the bigger authority. Okay, so we've talked state, employers, workers. What about the church itself? What role did Rerum Novarum see for the church in all this?
Well, it was huge. Rerum Novarum basically staked the church's claim to have a voice in modern public life. Its citizenship status, you could say. It established the church's right, even its duty, to speak out on these changing social and economic issues, and to offer moral solutions. It really set a precedent, a lasting paradigm. Pope Pius the Aleph later called it the Magna Charta, upon which all Christian activity in the social field ought to be based.
The Magna Charta, wow.
Yeah. So the church's role, teaching moral truths, encouraging charity, supporting organizations that help the poor and needy, it pointed to the church's long history of caring for the poor. And it's actually quite critical of the idea that state welfare can just replace that personal charitable action. It argued, no human expedience will ever make up for the devotedness and self-sacrifice of Christian charity. There's something irreplaceable there.
Okay, so just to circle back and make it super clear. On the question of property, Pope Leo III came down strongly for private property, seeing it as part of the solution, not the problem like the socialists did.
Absolutely, crystal clear on that. Riram Navaram pushes for reforms that uphold private property, along with individual freedom and human dignity. Those are the building blocks.
Mm.
It explicitly says, the law, therefore, should favor ownership, and its policy should be to induce as many as possible of the people to become owners.
So widespread ownership, not state ownership.
Precisely. The goal is more people becoming owners, having that stake, that security, not concentrating it all in the hands of the state. And ultimately, Poblio XIII's vision was really a call for everyone to work together, collaboration. He called on workers, employers, the state, the church, all parts of society to unite, to work for justice, to reduce that class conflict that seemed so inevitable to others. He envisioned a society built on mutual respect, shared goals, commitment to the common good.
That really does stand out compared to the idea of, you know, inevitable class warfare that was so prevalent then. It's a vision of cooperation, not conflict.
Totally different worldview. The encyclical hits this directly. It says, capital cannot do without labor, nor labor without capital. Their mutual harmony is the result aimed at.
Mm.
And it explicitly rejects the idea that class is naturally hostile to class. The exact contrary is the truth. It argues they need each other. They're interdependent.
So for our listeners trying to grasp the most concrete, maybe the most impactful practical changes it was pushing for, what were the key solutions Riram Navaram put on the table? What really broke new ground back then?
Okay, the practical solutions boil down to a few key things. First, like we said, just wages. Enough for a worker and their family to live decently, not just scrape by.
Right.
Second, worker associations or unions. Actively encouraged, giving workers that collective voice, that bargaining power.
Okay.
Third, limited work hours. Protecting workers' health, their family life. It actually says it's neither just nor human, so to grind men down with excessive labor.
Strong stuff.
Fourth, protection for the vulnerable. Special care needed for women and children in the workplace, making sure the work wasn't unsuitable or harmful for them. And finally, charity and solidarity. A real emphasis on the duty of the wealthy and the church to actively help the poor. Not just as an option, but as a moral obligation rooted in Christian charity.
So, yeah, not just paying enough to survive, but enough to live a decent family life. And backing unions, these really do sound radical for 1891. Okay, bringing it forward. Why should we still be talking about this document from, you know, over 130 years ago, here in 2025? What makes it stick? What really stands out to you about why it's still relevant?
Oh, it's incredibly relevant. Because the core issues haven't gone away, have they? Economic inequality, workers' rights, that constant tension between individual freedom and what we owe each other as a society. It speaks right into our modern debates about things like wage gaps, job insecurity, the ethics of how capitalism works today. What it offers is this balanced path. It avoids the extremes of pure laissez-faire, anything goes economics on one side, and state-controlled socialism on the other. It keeps insisting. Human dignity comes first, before profit, before ideology. And its legacy is huge. It didn't just influence thinking, it inspired actual social justice movements around the world. It continues to shape conversations about ethical economics. And as we mentioned, it really set the stage for all the major Catholic social encyclicals that followed, like Quadragesimo Anno in 1931, Centesimus Annus in 1991. It also helped really crystallize those three bedrock principles of Catholic social teaching. Human dignity, the absolute starting point. Everyone has inherent worth because they're made in God's image.
Okay.
Solidarity, which isn't just feeling sorry for people, but as John Paul II put it, a firm and persevering determination to commit oneself to the common good.
Mm.
Real commitment.
Right.
And subsidiarity, that principle we talked about, keeping decisions and functions at the most local level possible. Don't centralize unless you absolutely have to.
So yeah, whether you're listening as a worker, an employer, someone involved in policy, Riram Navaram offers this kind of moral framework, a compass maybe for trying to build a fairer, more just economy and society. Timeless wisdom, really. So as you think about everything we've unpacked from Riram Navaram, here's something to chew on. How could those core principles, human dignity, solidarity, subsidiarity, how could they apply to the economy today? Which is changing so fast, right? Think about things like the gig economy with its unique challenges, or artificial intelligence and what that means for jobs and labor. How might a Riram Navaram for the 21st century tackle these issues while still holding on to that fundamental balance, that balance between individual rights, our collective well-being, and the essential dignity of human work? Something to consider.